Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am Nicholas Lorimer, your host, and today I am joined by Mr. Marius Root. Marius, how are you doing, sir?
How's Nick?
And we are also joined by Mr. Gabriel Krauser, who is currently fighting off a bad case of wonton soup, which is doing much greater damage than that enchilada ever did to me a couple of days ago. Gabriel, how are you? Are you surviving your food poisoning?
No, man. I was so ready to pretend that it's all going well.
You're not doing well with things from the East at the moment, Gabriel. First was COVID, now this.
It's twice that that China has sabotaged your work this year. Anyway,
look, guys, he has a book from the East, Reinventing African Development. Best book, best ideas.
We should start calling Gabriel Mustache because China's screwing him as well.
That was very good. All right. Let us then not dilly-dally and get straight into the news of today. And, of course, this is something which I believe, and my colleagues will argue with me, I'm sure, if they disagree, that Cyril Ramaphosa is desperately trying to change the conversation and project an image of himself as a great and glorious world leader. And there's been a session of the UN recently where all the world leaders have been giving sort of speeches on various things. But Cyril Ramaphosa's speech included a call for reparations for victims of the slave trade. He said, quote, "We support the adoption of special measures, including affirmative action programs and targeted financial assistance as restitution to communities whose ancestors were sold into slavery. We further support all measures being undertaken to address the historic and contemporary discrimination against peoples of African descent." There was much then about how the world stands united behind the Durban Declaration and the platform for action against racism across the world. Gabriel, let's start with you. I'll leave something else. Never mind. I'll leave that for Marius to go on about. Gabriel, what do you make of this? What's Ramaphosa trying to do here? And what do you make of his suggestions overall?
I think that this is the issue of reparations for slavery and global affirmative action for black people. Because when our president says our people, he doesn't include me. And when he says African people of African descent, he doesn't include me either. Yeah. So that's unfortunate. Anyway, when people talk about these issues, I think there's one tendency to think, well, it's going to lead to trouble if you try and push back, and it'll lead to trouble if you follow down the road of reparations. So the best thing to do is kind of leave it be. But it's worth just noticing what the core values here are, because they're clear and they're winnable. The core value of justice is that a person is responsible for his or her own actions. So in terms of justice, you hold someone responsible if they've done it. You don't hold someone responsible for what someone else has done. And if you haven't done anything wrong, you don't get held responsible for what the next person did wrong. Likewise, if you have been victimized, you should be made whole in terms of delict or tort law. You can sue someone for the harm that you've suffered. Can't usually sue someone to get paid for the harm that someone else has suffered, unless you belong to a kind of corporate person, and when you get very well-defined units, then you can extend beyond the individual to just like a voluntarily incorporated group or something like that. Okay, so the principles of justice are you're responsible for what you do, and you get back what's been taken from you. Those principles absolutely must hold. They're good principles. We should all stand by those principles. And South Africa did actually stand by the principle of reparations in terms of land restitution, where people who were directly dispossessed of land or who were direct descendants of people directly dispossessed of land got evidence, went to the government, and they either got the land back or if they chose to, they got paid out. And 95% of those claims were completed, roughly 95, maybe 96, by the time Cyril Ramaphosa became president. Since then, there's been almost total standstill, as far as I can gather.
I believe about 90% of those people chose the money rather than land. But
correct.
not important for this, yes.
No, that's another debate. Okay, Landhugger, whatever. So that's good work, and it's crazy to me that no one wants to celebrate that. The president had the opportunity to celebrate it. Of course he doesn't celebrate it. Why not? Well, because he has literally been the worst at reparations for direct dispossession by the government in the history of the new South Africa. He's worse than Mandela, worse than Mbeki, worse than Kgalema Motlanthe. I think there were more land restitution cases settled under Kgalema Motlanthe, who was president for 5 minutes, than under Cyril Ramaphosa, although I do say that under correction. He's certainly worse than Zuma. He can't claim the win, because as soon as you claim the win, by the way, then you kind of lose some of the moral authority to go forward with the whole thing. So the point is that this is not something that the president actually wants to achieve in the very sphere where he could achieve it, a completion, as it were, of the restitution program. It's much more convenient to keep it as a political goalpost that you're always targeting at, because what does that do? As you say, it directs the gaze away from the potholes, the shacks that aren't lit, the steaming sewerage wafting up into the night sky to this grand vision of everyone of the same race united in one spiritual project of upliftment that has no practical means, no practical effect, but makes people feel enough to forget what's actually going on.
So, Marius, you pointed out something that I think is actually quite telling about this speech. And that you said to me before the show that it kind of came across as a speech that was simply cribbed from some sort of Western woke politician. And you can see that in this line from Ramaphosa's speech, he says, quote, "As we strive to correct the wrongs of the past, we must combat the racism, sexism, and national chauvinism of the present. Racism directed at ethnic minorities, migrants, refugees, and the LGBTQI plus community and other marginalized groups has led to a denial of opportunity to institutionalize discrimination and to violence." That reference to ethnic minorities, that certainly comes out of the rhetoric that we see in Europe and America. It's not a line that the ANC uses very often.
Yeah, and I mean, South Africa is one of the, I mean, greatest examples of where an ethnic majority was oppressed. And, you know, Southern Africa in general, too. But for some reason, that isn't. And you'd think Cyril Ramaphosa would remember this, but apparently he doesn't. So, you know, maybe Cyril Ramaphosa and AfriForum are having a sort of two night run. Maybe they're going to be, you know, the better friends in the future. I'm not too sure. So, but the issue of the reparations, the thing is, history does cast a long shadow. I remember I read something that said that people with Norman surnames, or that were derived from Norman surnames in the UK. So, you know, the Norman invasion from 1066, people with Norman surnames had higher incomes than people with Anglo-Saxon surnames, on average, obviously. So this shows, I mean, the Norman invasion was nearly 1,000 years ago. So it shows you
that... Wait, hold on. Yeah. Maurice, are you saying that I have an opportunity to try and get some reparations from the French, because I'm on board with that?
Why would my surname is, I mean, it's a Dutch surname, I'm some dude. I don't know, anyway. But it shows you, I mean, that obviously that history...
The Dutch were colonized by the Spanish, for sure.
Exactly, yeah. Then we threw off the Spanish yoke. It was one of the greatest times of history. But anyway, but it shows you, I mean, history does cast a long shadow. And, you know, is there some worth to this kind of thing? But then it all does start breaking down. Should somewhere like Jamaica get the same kind of reparations as a place called like Haiti, for example, where Jamaica's fairly well run, it's a middle income country, it's a democracy, you know, there's high levels of violence there, but I mean, same as South Africa. Kingston is also a very dangerous city, for example, but overall it's not a badly run place. You know, people aren't trying to get off the island like they're trying to get away from Cuba and Haiti, for example. So should somewhere like Jamaica get the same as Haiti? They're both countries with more than, I mean, I think Haiti's about 99% black. Jamaica's about 92% black, for example. So should they get the same kind of reparations? How are we going to do this, practically speaking? What about somebody who's mixed race? Do we go down to the level of the individual, or do we just look at countries where large proportion of the people are descended from former slaves? I mean, it breaks down at a practical level. How do we do this?
If you want, just right. A further point on the practical, the question is, Are you worse off if you've lost people because they've been taken as slaves? Because that means you've lost labor. Which, by the way, if that's what happened, then that in almost every case means that the people who were resident there were themselves slavers. But any event. Or are you worse off if you get the slaves, right? Like Haiti, if Haiti should be getting reparations, then America should also be getting reparations. Because the problem is it's had these enslaved people. But then America must also be giving reparations. Practically, it's just, it's a complete nightmare. But there's a simple solution. But the solution is to go to the other side. The first side is justice. What is just? It is just to be punished for what you have done and to be made whole for where you directly have been victimized. But justice is not everything. If we lived in a world that is truly just, I think Milton Friedman is right. If we all got what we deserved, none of us would have anything, actually. I'm a Hobbesian. Okay. The other side of things, justice is not everything. The other side is morality. But morality is clearly about helping those in need. A black person who's a billionaire is no more in need because they're black. They're, you know, someone who's well politically connected and so on. And a white beggar outside the house here is not in a position to escape hunger simply because of the color of his skin. So needs-based charity, you know, insofar as countries want to give away money, I think that it's become very unfashionable. It's become very easy to poo-poo. I have spent a little bit of time in Rwanda, Uganda, the Congo. I've seen what nets do to see communities rush to get malaria nets and the enthusiasm for a bag of rice or corn. Money for charity is a real thing. When it's need-based, that's hugely important, and that should be encouraged for those who need it. And I think that if you're covering need and you're covering justice, then you've covered the ground floor. Then you've covered like the reality. And then if someone still wants to look at the stars and imagine everyone with a black skin uniting in like a spiritual exercise, and everyone with a middle brown skin uniting in some other spiritual exercise, and everyone with a pink skin uniting in some other spiritual exercise, those Looney Tunes can have their entertainments. They don't really matter. They wouldn't really matter. Because need right. and justice would be met.
Right. Without and so we see here what is at the core of so much of our ill in South Africa and indeed around the world, which is this project of the sort of racial nationalism. That's what it is uniting people of a race in some sort of great spiritual quest. Rather than actually treating people as human beings and giving them the opportunities and the freedom to uplift themselves. Anyway, let us move on to our next topic, and that is, of course, back home in South Africa, while Cyril is out speaking to the world about creating universal cosmic justice, we have, shall we say, more mundane concerns. In a response to a parliamentary question asked by a DAMP, the Minister for Social Security, or Social Development rather, Lindiwe Zulu, said that there are approximately 177,000 public servants requiring social grants. Now, these social grants are everything from the child support grant, the disability grant, the grant for older persons. You may be somewhat perplexed by this because you're not allowed to receive a grant unless you have below a certain income. And as far as I understand, there are basically no public servants who meet that threshold for means testing. And in other words, there appears to be 200 million rand per month being siphoned off by 177,000 civil servants. There are a few grants that are allowed to be collected by civil servants, and those are the foster care grants for people looking after foster children. But there are honestly not that many people doing that in South Africa. So 200 million rand being sucked down the drain a month. Minister Zulu said that they would be investigating this and taking disciplinary action. Marius, what do you make of this? Is this simply a clerical error?
I think it's great news that Lindiwe Zulu said it's going to be investigated and, you know, the harsh tests will be taken. So I was actually quite worried that people were going to get away with this thing. But I'm very glad to hear that Minister Zulu is actually going to be cracking down on people. But yeah, but in all seriousness, though, it's, you know, I think I've mentioned before on the show, there's this meme. It's from a documentary about Chinese miners somewhere in Africa. And the guy's just saying it's also tiresome. And you can see how fed up the guy is. I think it's the same thing. And like, people aren't even shocked. I saw the headline. I was like, whatever. You know, you're so, like, people are new to it now in South Africa. Like, and we all know nothing's going to happen to one civil servant. There won't even be one person as a sacrificial lamb. Not one person will have to fall on their sword. And nothing's going to happen. We've seen, it goes back, there's no consequences for doing anything. I mean, we had soldiers beat a man to death in Alexandria last year, Collins Khoza. Nothing's happened to anybody. Nothing. A man was murdered by the state. Nobody cares. Nothing happened. Same kind of thing, yeah. Nobody cares. That's why these things happen as well. There's no consequences for your actions. And it also, I mean, but what do you expect? Lindiwe Zulu is, I mean, she's, this competition is stiff, but she's probably one of the worst ministers in the entire cabinet. And, I mean, we've seen also. Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, she's, we also saw at the beginning of the lockdown last year, I remember there was some, she was photographed going shopping in the V&A waterfront. And, you know, and people are saying to her, cool, like, you know, you're allowed to be out. But, I mean, you know, it was just before the actual lockdown happened. But, like, shouldn't you be setting an example? Shouldn't you be actually at home showing people what, you know, that we should be staying at home during the lockdown? But, and she was laughing at the person who was interviewing her and stuff. And you can see it's, she's not a serious person. And we also saw now with the recent National Social Security Fund, which she suggested is going to be an additional tax of about 12% on your take-home income, which is also going to affect poorer South Africans more than high-income South Africans. Or was it even cleared by anybody? It's just something she came up with, you know, her and her friends, you know, sitting around on the weekend, I don't know, you know, scribbling on a napkin.
At the V&A.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, yeah, but nobody's surprised.
Watching the ships come in, drinking some champagne. Oh, how can we squeeze the rich?
Exactly.
So, let's yeah, I mean, were 12% more than you're already exactly. doing it. That's exactly. a good idea. Ah, yes, cheers.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, so I mean, I'm not surprised by this, and it's just like, you know, yeah, like I say, it's just also tiresome, and we know nothing's really going to happen to anybody who's involved in this.
So our colleague Terence Corrigan always likes to say, you know, there's a we at the IRR obviously have a sort of ideological principles-based objection to a large state. We think that it's almost always bad. But even if you don't have that, South Africa just doesn't have the state capacity to pull off a lot of the grand projects envisioned. This is the argument that Terence makes, is that regardless of how you feel about big government in principle, Switzerland, Germany, the Australian civil service, the Singaporean civil service, we are not. And I think that this is an excellent example of that. We have here public servants who are already paid by the taxpayers, already suck up an absolutely enormous chunk of our budget, who appear to be, I guess, double dipping, seeing what they can scoop out from the fiscus above and beyond what they were already paid. Gabriel, do you agree with that line?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that it opens up the question, what is it that makes for a very good civil service? What is it that, in other words, Singapore has that we lack? Why is it that our civil servants are so eager to steal? And I think that you're going to, you know, any proper and complete answer would take a very long time to get through. But one of the essential ingredients is a sense of pride, right? So in the free markets, if you're a manager and everyone at the tills is stealing and you haven't figured out how to stop that from happening, then your little shop is going to go bust and some other little shop is going to take over the business of that area. The market will select against businesses that end up robbing, where staff end up robbing from the business a hell of a lot. But market forces don't apply in the civil service. In politics, theoretically, if you've got a political organization that doesn't know what it's doing, it's eventually going to be beaten by another political organization. Now, that hasn't happened in a while in South Africa, but I think people can be too defeatist. I think that, you know, there clearly have been some transitions of power. There clearly have been many voters who have changed their minds. And I think this election may be another surprise to the faithless who think that all South Africans are always mostly bound to vote one way. Put that to the side. That's just academic. In the civil service, it's a different thing. The civil service can't get voted out, and it can't get outcompeted through market forces. So how is it that in Singapore or Germany or Switzerland, you have civil servants without those other incentives who nevertheless do good work? And I think that the classic Weberian answer is something like there's a sense of work ethic combined with pride in the national project. In other words, patriotism. In other words, the best place to test how patriotic your country is how effectively does the civil service work? And that connects back to what Marius is saying. If you want to see, if you think that there's a good case for South Africa, and there is sometimes, you want to see how deep it goes, how sadly it doesn't go deep enough, you look at the fact that the story's going nowhere. That, nearly 200,000 civil servants have been caught stealing. And most people will be like, okay, whatever. Our expectations are so low. Your duty of care over the public purse is so meh that people kind of throw it up. And it's a really weird one, but in that sense too, we kind of get the civil service we deserve. And every country does. Countries where people get furious about this kind of thing, where they'd like, that we're getting angry and following it up and always, where that's like the national anthem, they get to keep good civil service, good civil services in general. And countries that shrug it off, don't.
I like that point about patriotism, and I'd like to say add to that patriotism has been used, especially since 94, by the ANC in a very toxic way, which is that it's often used to bash people who object to it. It's identified itself and the state with the nation and said that these two things are one and the same. So if you criticize the government, you're being unpatriotic. If you go overseas and complain about the ANC's attempt to destroy property rights in South Africa, you're being unpatriotic. And that's very, I think that is very toxic for our political debate. It's often used by tyrants and authoritarians to suppress dissent by accusing their opponents of being unpatriotic. Mm. And honestly, the patriotic thing to do is to stand up against toxic policies and ideas.
If you see someone stealing and you stop them, that's already a very good thing to do. If you see someone stealing from the fiscus, from the taxpayer, and you try and stop them, that is literally the most patriotic thing you can do, just about.
Right.
It's great.
And my big fat head blocks it, but for those of you watching on YouTube, you can see that I actually do have a South African flag behind me on the door.
You've got two South African flags, Nick. You're clearly setting up for the long weekend, eh?
Heritage Day.
Heritage Day tomorrow. Anyway, let's continue to our last story for today. And this is, I think, one of those signs that South Africa sort of continues to make a plan despite the terrible ideas that govern our political life. And that is the South African Post Office is expanding its pilot project of allowing the collection of 350 Rand social relief of distress grant to supermarket chains around the country. And the latest supermarket they're targeting is Spar. So this is continuing a trend that we've seen, I think, for a long time in South Africa of when it comes down to actually implementing things on the ground, state capacity is so weak that despite all of the grand plans and, sort of socialist dreams of our overlords, at the end of the day, they often have to compromise with the private sector and let the private sector step in. So in this case, people are going to be able to collect social grants from SPAR. People already can get, I think, certain documents that come from Home Affairs, like I think passport renewals and stuff done at South African banks. In middle-class areas, even though it's frowned upon by the upper echelons of the police, we find that security companies are effectively becoming an arm of the police force, where they cooperate incredibly closely with the police. And while they don't technically arrest anyone, they effectively do, and they hand them over to the police. So we're in this world where, despite the government's attempts to just clutch onto all power and centralize everything in the state, things just keep sort of slipping out of their grasp here and there. And in many ways, we're actually far more of a privatized society than some others. And I suspect that that's one of the reasons why South Africa continues to keep on kicking, despite a lot of misrule over the last decade. Gabriel, is my thesis there insane, or what do you make of this?
No, dude, you're totally right. That we have, how does Terence put it? Terence says we have a ruling party that is not capable of and not always interested in governing. So sometimes when you're in the not so interested in part, then it will hand over the reins to private business. I do worry about this example, though, because of the fact that it's being meted out to companies asymmetrically. So Boxer, and Boxers are, you know, if you go around rural South Africa, you're going to see a Boxer more likely than not in a small town. Boxers and Pick and Pay have been granted like the first trialing. Now the talk is to extend that to Spar as well. Conspicuously absent ShopRite. Now, ShopRite Checkers in Sandton has gone zhuzh with sushi, but there's still a lot of ShopRite units, hundreds if not thousands around the country, that are very well placed to service these areas. So this is not just like complaining Woolworths. Why is Woolworths not on the thing? Honestly, Woolworths probably should be on the thing too, but never mind that. ShopRite would be very useful. It's not on there. I can't imagine that's because ShopRite doesn't want it. So wherever you have private-public partnerships, you also have this question of, is the government choosing one company to help out against another one? And in so doing, has it got like basically leverage to encourage companies not to resist it, not to criticize it in public, not to, you know, slacken on its transformation quotas, whatever the case may be. We've seen this with Discovery, for example, in the health sector, getting very close with the government in terms of COVID response in the build-up to the nationalization of everything health-wise. Yes, I like it. Ultimately, I'd like it best if the government could do the bits that it really has to do, and the government has to pay out the grant that is from the taxpayer to go to poor people that really need it, not on a race basis. The government must do that, and I kind of wish that it would just flip and figure out how to do one thing right.
Yeah, no, I agree with that note of caution. And of course, this is the problem is this sort of relationship can go both ways, is that private sector has, you know, in theory, some capacity to influence the state in this direction, but also the other way, the state can pick and choose winners and distort the economy and control the economy through that. Maurice, what do you make of this?
Yeah, I think it's one of the times when reality is meeting ideology, and government is showing that it can't really, despite its wish to control basically every aspect of South Africans' lives, can't do that. That's why it's had to outsource a lot of this kind of stuff. I have to say, when last time I applied for a passport, I applied on the Monday at FNB, got the SMS on the Thursday saying it was ready. But lots of people aren't in that kind of position. A lot of people probably have to go stand in a queue, you know, under the baking sun and try to get there at 5 a.m. so that they can be able to go get their birth certificate or whatever the case is that they need to get from Home Affairs. But the question is, will ideology win or will reality win? Because it's not a done deal that reality will win over ideology. And we've seen, I think, our neighbors to the north, Zimbabwe, is a very good example of where, despite reality being this massive brick wall, the ideology of the governing party, they continue to ignore reality and continue to push ahead with really bad ideas and decisions and so on. And we've seen what's happened in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is now, it's basically a failed state, you know, and I think everybody listening to this thing now probably, you know, we come across the Zimbabweans every day in our daily life, whether it's as waiters or as colleagues or whatever the case is, because of the collapse of their country. And it's all because of the governing party there decided that it never accepted reality and ideology was the winner there, and it seems what's happened there. And it's not impossible the same thing could happen in this country.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening. Please support the Institute of Race Relations by going to irr.org.za and clicking the Join Us button, signing up to become a friend of the Institute. That's the best way to back us. Also, check out todayfriend.co.za, and we will see you next week. We hope that you have a lovely Heritage Day. and that you celebrate all of the glorious things that make you and make you a South African, and have a good and relaxing long weekend if you are indeed able to do so. And with that...
Wait, if I can just say one other thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you're into heritage, on Heritage Day, and you watch The Daily Friend, you might want to just think on the heritage of the Institute of Race Relations, because it's a pretty weird one, and Anthea Jeffrey has a piece that is about at least that bit of history that defined the IRR from about 1985 to 1995, a very important part of this institute's history, which is kind of catches one on the nose a little bit. So I strongly recommend that as like happy Heritage Day. Can one really say happy in this country anyway? A jolly interesting Heritage Day experience.
Exactly. There we go. Well said. Anyway, thank you very much, and we'll see you next week. Cheers.